Tea Party help for the governor. The TV ads in support of a tax cut. BMV lawsuit. Were we all overcharged for driver's licenses? Casino competition from Ohio, a synthetic drug bill on hold, and a Hispanic Democrat switches to the GOP. That plus Indianapolis as a spring break destination and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 8,
2013. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.
This week, TV ads from a Tea Party group hit the air. The idea is to drum up support for the tax cut sought by Governor Mike Pence. The president of Virginia-based Americans for Prosperity, Tim Phillips, came to the State House to announce a tax cut campaign that will include grassroots organizing and multimedia messaging.
We believe Governor Mike Pence is absolutely on the right track.
Americans for Prosperity was founded by David Koch, a New York industrialist who is a big Republican giver as well as a donor to Mike Pence. Pence ran on the tax cut promise, but saw fellow Republicans remove it from his budget proposal in the Indiana House.
This is a 10% income tax cut for all Hoosiers, and that's the issue that we're targeting, and that's the focus of our message.
Among those targeted by the ad campaign is House Speaker Brian Bosma.
Look, you're looking at a guy that's had death threats, people camped on my front door, had participated in millions of dollars of paid advertising on both sides. So my focus will be on making the right decision.
Will the ads make a difference inside the State House? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Mike McDaniel, is this a good addition to the tax cut debate?
It's hard to say whether this would be effective because, first of all, the strategy is interesting to me. If they're trying to affect the overall attitude of legislators and you're only buying the Indianapolis market, and we don't know how big that buy is.
They say it's a six-figure buy.
Well, that could be, you know, $100,000, and that doesn't get you much. But if they're trying to affect the outcomes of attitudes of legislators from around the state, the only way that's going to change attitudes is if they hear from people in their districts. And that's the way it really has an effect on legislators, and I don't see this doing that. If they're trying to get the leadership in the House and the Senate to change their attitudes, and it really what's interesting to me is there really is a need to change attitudes at this point. Both sides have said we're going to wait until April 17th when the revenue forecast comes out to know how much money we're dealing with.
Bosma says there will be a tax cut, but he won't commit to
what type
or how big.
That's right. It could be the speed up the inheritance tax. It could be any one of a variety of things. But they've said all along that that's still on the table. So I'm not sure how effective this is going to be in the long haul.
So if you're Mike Pence, do you look at this as being a good thing? Do you try to exert some influence and stop it if not?
Well, Mike Pence wants to curry favor with the Koch brothers. He has all along. We had a referendum on the Tea Party last year. And what we showed in Indiana is that the Tea Party has some sway in the Republican primary nomination and not in the general election. Now, the interesting part of this is that with the redistricting of those House seats particularly, for a lot of the Republicans in there, the threat only comes in the primary. And so that begs the question, is the next step, if they do the fiscally responsible thing? I mean, we've cut We've cut education funding by the hundreds of millions. There isn't enough money for roads since major moves isn't generating anything. So you've got all of these pent-up needs. And if you take the fiscally responsible position, as Basma and Long are doing, and say, you know, we got to make sure the money's there, well, okay, you don't have them going along with you. Do you then run Republicans against those Republicans in the primary? That's the question.
There are some subtleties in this ad. I'm not sure you'll catch the subtleties in the ad.
You particularly, John.
Unless you pay attention, like some of us do. I mean, they use music that was used in a Mitch Daniels ad over 4 years ago, and they're trying to send the message that things aren't the way they are now, the way they were when Mitch Daniels was here.
I think this whole thing is a little too clever. And trying to be a little too cute. And I don't think they've paid attention to either the electorate, as Ann says, or they haven't paid attention to the polling that's out there by several groups that have actually specifically asked what they think about this income tax cut. And the general public has generally cited, and with pretty good majorities in some of these polls, that they would rather see the money that's there used for things like education or roads as opposed to a tax cut on income. And I think that Mike's scenario is exactly right. You want to make sure that the economy is producing at a level high enough to afford taking half a billion dollars out of the revenue stream and trying to do all these other things before you do that, because we saw when it happened in 1997. You make a tax cut now, the recession doesn't improve, you're looking at deficits in a couple of years. They don't want that.
Might this be more about recruiting for Americans for Prosperity than it is about actually having an effect on the tax cut?
What a cynical idea.
Maybe, Jim. You're right. Nothing happens in a vacuum. I mean, this has Americans for Prosperity deals not only with issues on the national level, but increasingly on a state-by-state level. They were very involved, for instance, in Wisconsin in backing Governor Scott Walker and some of the battles he had with teachers' unions and others. And they were successful, as was noted, in, say, 2010, in helping Republicans gain control of the U.S. House. However, it's not as if, here comes Americans for Prosperity, you know, battle's over, they're going to win. If you look at many of the battles they've waged, they've lost, whether it was against health care reform, whether it was against Barack Obama. There are lots of things like against the stimulus. Even beyond Barack Obama, they were opposed to the stimulus package. So. Other than the high water mark, you might say, in 2010 with the U.S. House, they haven't had a whole lot of successes, despite having spent, for instance, in the case of defeating Barack Obama, upwards of, $140 million in the case of the Koch brothers. But I think what this really is the mood of the electorate. I think John's right. The polling that I've seen, in fact, that Wish TV did before the session, suggested even that there was a willingness on the part of many Hoosiers to have not just a tax cut, but a tax increase if it were going to the right kinds of purposes.
The tax cut individually is meaningless, okay? It you know, the average millionaire will save $2,100.
Well, they're also arguing. They're also arguing in this ad that there's too much spending and
yeah, well, we've cut that back dramatically. But $2,100 is not going to start a new business. It's not going to hire more employees. It's not going to be an economic stimulus. And for the average Hoosier, it's $160. But aggregated, it's roads and it's school teachers and it's things that people care about. So that's why there's not the drumbeat for it. And I think they're going upstream with this one too.
A lawsuit filed this week says that Indiana drivers have been overcharged when they renew or obtain a driver's license. The lawsuit says the state should pay tens of millions of dollars back. It was filed by Indianapolis attorney Irwin Levin. He claims the Bureau of Motor Vehicles charged every driver under the age of 75 up to $7 more than it should. Levin says drivers should get that money back plus interest.
The key in these cases is that the wrongdoer, in this case, the government of the people, should disgorge the money and have it go back to the individuals who overpaid the money.
And Delaney, how could this happen?
Well, if you don't read the Indiana Code, it can happen. I mean, if you want to charge whatever you want to charge, regardless of what the legislature says you can charge, then you can do it. And, you know, I hope it's not correct, because we're talking about a hit to the general bottom line of $30 to $40 million. And on top of, you know, the mismanagement in the Department of Revenue, this begins to look like Keystone Cops.
Actually, you know, the BMV has gotten all sorts of national awards for improving their service. It's kind of alarming to now get this news, isn't it?
You're assuming that it's correct, and if it's correct, and what I understand is that if you take the administrative code changes and the statutory changes that have been made and add them up, that's how they come to the fee structure that they have. Legislatures ask for a variety of things to change, various service charges. A fee for the creation of the new photo IDs to meet the federal standards. All of those, as they've done these things every step of the way, when you add those all up, that's how they come to the dollar amount that they're charging.
So you think there's an adequate defense for
this
lawsuit?
I think there will be an adequate defense of this when it's put out in front of a court.
Okay.
I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I have not read the pertinent portion of the statute, so I have no idea.
The BMV, frankly, the BMV has said simply it's in litigation, so we can't comment.
Based on what I've heard already, if it's explicit,
it doesn't matter that it's in litigation unless there's a gag order on there. And I think we would have heard from the people in the newspaper industry.
I'm saying is the response has been a non-response.
Would think if they had a response that was as clear-cut as Mike thinks it is, they'd put it out.
Well, but if it's explicit and it says you shall charge X, Y, or Z, that's one thing. But based on what I'm hearing here, when you talk about you shall make reasonable allowances for this and this improvement and that improvement, then it becomes a lot more nebulous, and all of a sudden then what may seem like it's cut and dried or in black and white is all of a sudden becomes a lot grayer.
Clearly Irwin Levin has got something going that he thinks is going to go beyond the BMV.
He won't say how he stumbled into this.
Right. He won't say how he stumbled into it, but he thinks that he's found a difference between what the law says and what the state's been charging, and has indicated that he thinks it goes beyond the BMV and maybe into many other areas. And if that's the case, this could be an interesting set of circumstances.
These could be hidden taxes. Lower them for the press and then sneak them in.
Yeah.
Hire them, get them elsewhere. Shocking.
Moving on. A new casino opened in Cincinnati this week, and that's a reason for concern at the State House. The new Horseshoe Casino in downtown Cincinnati is expected to take business away from half a dozen Indiana riverboats and racinos, and that's why state lawmakers are considering changes in Indiana gaming laws. A casino bill that passed the state Senate calls for table games at racinos that would allow riverboat casinos to move to dry ground. Democrat Terry Gooden is the House sponsor of the bill.
Once when we enjoyed the monopoly of having no gaming around us, now that has changed. So we've got to look at a new way of doing business.
It is not our ambition to either expand or contract gaming in Indiana. My ambition is status quo.
And that's what the governor said last week. John Katzenberger, can casinos get a boost without an expansion of gambling?
The expansion of gambling has always been a rather iffy thing.
It's in the eye of the beholder.
It's definitely in the eye of the beholder. But I do think that there's something else that's in the mix that really hasn't surfaced in legislation yet. And that's really what the Casino Association is looking at. There's a scheme that requires taxation on if you send a coupon to John here and you give him a voucher to go gambling at a casino, they get taxed when they send that out and taxed when he cashes it in. And they're looking to eliminate that tax so that they can boost their marketing budgets, and that's what they hope will help counteract the competition from Ohio and other places as well. So I think there are definitely efforts to try to help the casinos boost their business to overcome this potential loss, but it's a long way from being law at this point.
The governor won't say what he thinks is an expansion. Brian Bosma says he thinks the bill is a big expansion. David Long says it's not.
This does show the complexity of the bill, because there isn't a simple solution to prop up the gaming industry in Indiana. Even you talk about moving casinos, allowing casinos that operate now in Indiana to move from water-based casinos to land. There's not even a uniform opinion within the industry in Indiana about that question. Some say that would be great.
Right.
Others say, no, don't do that. That's only going to cost us more money in the long run. So even something as seemingly simple, I hesitate to use the word, is that is not as easy as it seems. The problem here is beyond, I think Indiana can do some things to boost the margins of the operators, but the fact of the matter is, and there's, I don't know how you get around this, market saturation. You have it now with the four casinos in Ohio, and the governor of Kentucky has been trying unsuccessfully thus far since, 2007
every year
to bring casinos to that state. And I think what we'll probably see is, when you see your neighboring states cashing in, Kentucky may say at some point, we want a piece of it. And guess what? Then that further cuts that pie into tinier and tinier slices.
There are issues here other than market saturation, too, though. That I understand that casino in Ohio, in Cincinnati, is non-smoking. And people may drive by casinos in Indiana to get there for that reason.
Could be. But what's driving this particular piece of legislation is the fact that revenues for gaming have gone down with this recession, as it has all across the country. And Indiana has become more reliant on that gaming revenue through the years as an actual part of the budget. Where we started, we were just going to spend it on major capital programs. Well, that didn't last long.
Gambling taxes bring in more than the corporate tax at this point.
It's now back the other way.
It's flipped back now.
But they're pretty close. Yeah. But what's going on here is because of the onslaught of the new competition from Ohio, what could be Kentucky, Michigan with the Indian casinos and so forth and so on, the idea is to strengthen the core. And so if you bring table games to the two casinos in central Indiana, is that an expansion? We have table games. Can't do it in central Indiana. No, we have table games in other parts of the state.
But
is that an expansion? No.
It depends on whether you want it or you don't.
But that's exactly right. And having the move off the water into the land where the boats are now, as long as you have this still property there, is that an expansion?
I mean,
that's the kind of stuff they're talking about here.
See, all you have to do is just drain the water.
That's exactly right. I mean, the whole boat and a moat thing was silly in the first place, you know.
Yeah. But the problem is that the revenue is going down, and they can make adjustments on it. But that's again points out why that 10% across-the-board income tax cut is a bad idea.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, will you gamble at an Ohio casino? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, I don't gamble. Last week's question was, is the call for a constitutional convention a kooky idea? 41% said yes, 27% said no, 32% said wacky is a better description. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The battle to stop the spread of synthetic drugs hit a snag at the State House this week. By now, we're all familiar with the images of young people experiencing bad reactions to synthetic drugs, reactions that sometimes lead to suicide. Governor Mitch Daniels signed a law last year designed to ban them, but in July, an iTeam8 report spelled out problems with it. A Lawrence police bust at a smoke shop confiscated over 400 packets of synthetic marijuana that were later found to be legal. So now lawmakers in a House committee are seeking to create a more effective law.
These are drugs. These are drugs. And it's time that we stop them. If it walks like a skunk and it smells like a skunk, it's a skunk.
You throw a net that could snare in it law-abiding citizens who are suddenly committing a crime they had no intention to commit, and they didn't actually commit.
That's Larry Landis of the Public Defenders Council, preceded by State Senator Jim Merritt. The concern voiced by Landis prompted lawmakers to delay a vote on the bill for at least a week. John Schwanis, can effective legislation be drafted? This is the third year they've tried. So far, no success.
Right. It's been tough here. It's been tough in every state. It's kind of what we just were talking about, the complexities of trying to prop up the casino industry. This makes that almost look easy in comparison, because what you have, what Indiana has done in the past is you identify the substance that's perceived to be the problem, the compound. You put that on that formulation on the list of controlled substances and on the no-no list, and
then they said the Board of Pharmacy could add substances.
Right.
But last year they signed a bill. It took effect July 1st. On July 2nd, somebody found a way around it.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, to your point and the story that you cited, where you have these 400 packets where one would assume that something in one of those 400 packets would be on the prohibited list, but no.
Yeah.
And so how to chase that in a way that is constitutional, and as Larry Landis of the Public Defenders Council said, is not going to ensnare innocent people, that's tough. I don't know how you do that.
You got to do something.
Well, yeah, because it does cause problems for a lot of people, but we see these substances all the time. I mean, a lot of people look at those energy drinks as a similar type of potentially dangerous substance, and they're available all over the place. I think that at some point common sense has to prevail, but you know, I think that the difficulty of understanding exactly where that is makes this a difficult process.
Yeah, Senator Merritt wants to get something to the governor as quickly as possible with an emergency clause included. The committee wants to slow down.
The committee is looking for a way to define this in such a way that everybody understands what is tolerated and what isn't. You can't pass a criminal law that is as vague and as difficult to enforce as this is, or as it was. You've got to be able to spell it out so that people that are taking these kinds of actions understand that they're violating the law, and people selling them understand that as well. It can't just be a grab bag. Well, we don't like that, so that may not be on the list, but we're going to get you anyway. You can't do that. And it's not responsible on Senator Merritt's part to rush something through in something this complicated.
Part of his argument is that there are bad actors out there. There are people who will sell something if they know that it's not technically illegal, even though they intend
it
to do harm.
They know it's technically legal, too, if they're that bad. So that's not going to stop it.
Do they come up with a bill?
I think they will come up with a bill. And I think even if they feel like they're going to err on the side of going a little too far with this, and the reason I say that is because this is a very serious problem. And Senator Merritt is passionate about it, and should be, because it's killing especially young people. And, you know, the problem is when they change one change in a compound, you get around the law when you try to write it so specific. So as John said, how do you figure out how to throw that net out there and get the people you want to get without hurting others? But I do think they will come up with a bill. Now, whether or not that bill will pass the muster of the legal system, that's another question.
You know, as you back out at this issue and you look at controlled substances generally, a fascinating story, it seems to me, is in this climate of less regulation, less regulation.
We're talking about decriminalizing marijuana.
Look at the methamphetamine regulations and cold remedies, which will probably now be...
No, they delayed that bill, too.
Broad problems. Yeah.
Jose Evans ran for mayor of Indianapolis as a Democrat in 2011. This week he announced he's joining the Republican Party. Evans is a member of the City County Council who's in his second term. His party switch will reduce the Democratic majority on the council from 16-13 to the narrowest of margins at 15-14. He appeared with local and state GOP leaders to make the announcement at the city market.
I've become frustrated with political games being played by the Democratic Party, the lack of ideas, the infighting.
I helped Jose get elected as a Democrat twice now, and now I look forward to helping a Democrat get elected in his seat.
Marion County Democratic Chairman Joel Miller there. Jose Evans met also this week with GOP National Chairman Reince Priebus and Delaney Reince Priebus.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Is
good.
This a symptom of bigger problems for the Democrats?
No, I think this is a symptom of Jose Evans. I have no quarrel with the fact that you can change your party affiliation. I mean, he's free to make whatever mistakes he wants to make, but he ought to resign because he was elected as a Democrat and he's misled the electorate. And
what will happen? A lot of Republicans voted for him.
Yeah, well, that's a heavily Democratic district, and guess what? A lot of them won't vote for him the next time around, so maybe he won't even run for election again.
That is the honorable thing to do, isn't it?
No, I think he should stay exactly where he is. He's decided that philosophically he's at a different place than they are, and those are always very difficult decisions for anybody, whether it's going the direction he went to our party or he goes the other way. And it'll be corrected in the next election, and they'll either vote for him as Republican or they won't.
Priebus wanted to meet with him because he's trying to attract Hispanics to the Republican Party.
I bet he is.
Yeah, does this help?
I mean, if this happens 1,000 times across the country, yes, but I haven't seen any big exodus from leadership ranks of the Democratic Party. And his principle and political realities are probably, in this case, two different things, because Marion County, if you look at the direction and the political affiliations and demographics, I'm not sure it's not a smart switch from a pure political sense.
Will the Republicans trust Jose Evans?
Oh, yeah. They're grateful for the addition. They'll trust him just fine. Whether he's reelected is another big question.
Finally, families looking for a spring break destination should consider Indianapolis, according to a website that highlights happenings in small to mid-sized cities. Livability.com ranked Indianapolis among the 10 top spring break destinations for families in 2013. It was ranked fifth overall. In first place, Santa Cruz, California, followed by Tucson, Portland, and Omaha. The site urges visitors to check out, among other things, the Indianapolis Zoo, Broad Ripple Park, the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, and the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Mike McDaniel, good advice?
Absolutely. Indianapolis is one of the great
spring break.
Absolutely. Indianapolis is one of the great family-friendly cities in all of America. Anytime you get this kind of exposure nationally, it can do nothing but good things for the city.
Where are you going for spring break?
It's terrible advice. I'm staying here for spring break. It's terrible advice. They never even mentioned the Children's Museum. You're talking about bringing families here, and they don't mention the premier children's thing.
You don't want to bring them here at all.
I'm going to spend part of my spring break here. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.